Just a heads up, everyone. This podcast features adults having adult conversations, and there might be the chance of adult language. Also, we may talk about some difficult grieving experiences and themes of mental distress that can trigger some people. If this conversation stirs up some hard emotions for you, please reach out to someone you trust. Hi. I'm Tatiana Rotere, and you are listening to Crazy Grief, the podcast. Grief can make us feel like we're going crazy. It affects our emotions, our physical health, and our mental state. It has a huge impact in the way we relate to people and the way we see ourselves. Crazy Grief is a safe space for us to have candid conversations about grief and all the crazy stuff that comes with it. We are here to share our stories, how we cope with grief, and what kind of help really helps. If you lost your person and you feel like you're going crazy, let me reassure you, you're not going crazy. You're just grieving. So, let's talk about it. So today on Crazy Grief, we have Pauline. Pauline was born and raised in Auckland in New Zealand 11 years following the end of World War II, which makes her a baby boomer. But I must say, one of the coolest baby boomers I personally know. She initially trained as a registered nurse, but after a few years, she returned to university to train in psychology. Pauline now practices as a psychotherapist in her agency, Insight, where she provides counseling and therapy sessions online as well as face-to-face, of course, when we are not on lockdown. Pauline created and developed a model of therapy, insight-focused neurotherapy, IFNT, which is the modality she uses with her clients, and she also provides training for professionals in this method, mainly in Europe and New Zealand. And I must add, Pauline has been my personal therapist on and off for the last 3 years. I started having therapy sessions with her a couple of months after Jason died, and I must say, having her as a therapist walking alongside with me in my grief journey has been nothing short of life-saving. And I really mean it, life-saving. In times of intense mental and emotional distress, applying her guidance has made a huge change for the better in my life. Pauline, it is more than a pleasure to have you on Crazy Grief today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Tatiana. Nice to be here with you.
It's so, I'm looking forward to actually to have this conversation outside of me just, you know, pouring all my problems onto you. Yes. And thank you so much for just, I remember very early on when I started having counseling with you, there were lots of things that really stuck to me, but one of them was that I couldn't see a way through. Mm-hmm. My grief was so intense at that time that I just could not see that it will ever be any better. Mm. And I remember you saying to me that, you know, I was going to be okay and that you would hold the hope for me. Mm. And that meant a lot because I think a lot of times when somebody's grieving, and I know this was for me, I couldn't see any hope. And how do I see my life carrying forward without my husband? It was really painful. So having someone that has seen a lot of people overcome a lot of really difficult things in life saying to me, you are okay, and I'm going to hold the hope for you meant a lot to me. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I want to start by asking you to share with us a little bit more about what is insight-focused neurotherapy.
Okay. So insight-focused neurotherapy is a therapeutic model for therapy, for counseling. And it is, as the name suggests, it's about gaining insight into whatever it is that you're experiencing at the time. And through focusing in a particular way. And we focus on mindfulness in particular, a mindful way of being, which is to be present in the present moment without judgment, noticing and focusing on what it is. And the in this particular environment that we create with this therapeutic model, it allows for insights to emerge. And these insights are aha moments or life-changing insights that, or revelations, if you like, that lead people into a new awareness that they wouldn't otherwise be able to achieve. And it works on the principle, on the base principles of neuroscience, that we can harness the power, the changing power of the brain, if we know how to create the right kind of environment for that to take place. So it's a little bit like, you know, if you create an environment, a healthy, safe environment for a child, to they will learn more readily than if you're in a scary environment where they feel afraid and that they might get punished, then they're less likely to learn effectively. So we create this kind of environment where the brain feels safe, and in so doing, the insights are likely to emerge. And these insights, things that people have not or would not be otherwise able to think into being, are awarenesses that change their perspective quite dramatically and remarkably. And these insights lead to what we call brain change, or a change in the neurological structures of the brain that lead to permanent, ongoing, life-changing change.
And I can testify that I've experienced that, because when I first came to you in our, actually a few months when we started doing our therapy sessions, a feeling that I had, was that the pain that I was feeling, the emotional pain that I was feeling, that was also translating into physical pain and mental distress, I felt like that was going to be perpetual. It was almost like, and I learned lots of terms with you, you know, catastrophizing. I was looking at my present situation and I was projecting that into my future, into the next hour, into the next day, into the next year, into the rest of my life without my husband. So I was catastrophizing, but I was also like perpetuating that pain. And I remember having this massive aha moment in one of our counseling sessions, which was like, in this moment, I'm actually okay. And so that means that the pain is going to be present, but it's not going to be perpetual, and it's not going to be completely taking over my life every single moment of every single day. And that was a huge moment for me.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the thing about any kind of trauma, is that it captivates us and it captures our attention. And because it does captivate us and capture our attention, then it's like the focus is entirely on whatever it is that you're experiencing, whether it's pain, whether it's grief, whether it's catastrophizing, etc. It matters not what you're focusing on. What matters is that you get stuck in it. And because we get stuck in it, then we feel as if it's going to be a perpetual, ongoing scenario. And we don't generally, you know, general public doesn't know how to get ourselves out of it. It's a little bit like a, I can't remember the name of the knot, but the knot that you try to undo by pulling it all apart. And of course, it doesn't, it won't come apart. You have to know how to slip the pieces of rope in a certain way to be able to pull it apart. And it's so it is with the brain. You know, the things that we intuitively do to try and get out of our stuck situation actually entwine us more deeply into it.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, so what happens is that that a certain brain state, so if you think about our brain as a neurological structure, somewhat like the galaxy of the stars, then we have constellations in the galaxy, and those constellations we call brain states. And a brain state is a selection of neurons that are collected together that contribute to a brain state. And these are experiences that we've had that all revolve around one particular thing. So, for example, if you have a dog bite when you're a three-year-old and then you live next to a dog that's barking in your neighbor's yard, and every morning you wake up as a three-year-old, you know, you have the sound of the dog. And then you look over the fence and the dog jumps up and tries to bite you again. And this goes on for you over a number of years. Then what you're going to do as a three-year-old, four-year-old, five-year-old is you're going to be creating a constellation of dog, you know, scary dog memories that all collect in one spot in your brain. Now, let's say, you know, you're now 20 years old and you go to, let's say, a concert, you know, in the park. And, you know, there are some security guards who have growling dogs. Then as soon as you hear that growling dog sound, it's going to activate that mind state, that galaxy, that constellation, sorry, that you developed as a little person. And immediately you're going to be, that mind state is going to be activated and it's going to be present to you. So it sort of comes forward, if you like, and then that's, that becomes your awareness, and then everything else fades out. So it's like this concept of figure and ground, that whatever we focus on in the present moment becomes the thing that we experience, and everything else becomes the ground. It sort of fades away. And as such, then, or, you know, it's like we get blinded by this one thing, and then we lose touch on anything else that we, you know, that we do know about, but we can't actually access in that moment. And so it feels like we're, you know, the only thing we know right now is that dog constellation. And so we have the fear, we have the experience, we have the memories, we have the coping mechanisms, and we just get stuck in it.
So what I think is really fascinating about this is that, like, in my experience, for example, so I had when Jason passed away, there were lots of things from my childhood and lots of traumas that I had in the past that I thought I had dealt with because they didn't quite bother me as much. Or if things came back to my memory, or if I had, you know, just a little tiny relapse, I was able to bounce back or kind of just forget about it. And I thought that I was okay. And they were big traumas. But when Jason died, it was almost like all those traumas, they were not really dealt with, or they were not, I didn't get rid of them. They were somewhat in a dormant state. And when he died, the trauma got me almost re-traumatized because I had been, you know, already captivated and captured and so in those areas of my brain. And so his death brought it all back up, and it came with a vengeance. So I, what you're saying, I can definitely relate to. There were lots of things that I was coping okay before, and then right after he died, I couldn't cope anymore. And I really blame myself for that. And I think that that's a common thing that people think, why am I so weak? You know, when there's nothing to do with weakness, it's to do with how our brains have kind of clustered certain traumas and store them. And then an event like the death of a loved one can re-trigger those things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And talking about like re-triggering brain traumas, one of the things that I also experienced was this thing called widow's brain. Our widow's fog. And I came across that term because I started Googling what is wrong with me, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, kind of going, I'm losing my mind. What's wrong with me? Please Google, tell me. And I came across that, and I remember talking to you about it, which has to do with my brain did not work properly according to my experience before Jason's death. And things like I forgot lots of things. I couldn't remember simple things. I couldn't. I'm nursing a concussion right now, and so I it's so frustrating sometimes to not remember what I was just saying. And that's how it was before, but I didn't have a concussion then. But something, there was a trauma to my brain that also blocked certain memories. Like I remember during Jason's funeral, people would say to me, "Oh, and when this happened," and I really had no memory of that, and I felt like I was constantly walking around in a fog. I couldn't remember things. I couldn't remember simple things. I couldn't remember my PIN number for my card. It was just like this, my brain became a mush. Why? What is that? Why does that happen to us when we have a big trauma?
Yeah, so it's basically the anxiety bias of the brain. And it's, you know, there's a fabulous neuroscientist called Stephen Porges who talks about this in quite some depth. And he calls this five principles, evolutionary reasons why we require therapy as human beings. And that is simply because we are wired in this way to pay attention to things that are most dangerous. And of course, a death of a loved one, the severing of your attachment, the security of your connection to this person, the scariness of the future without this person is just enormous, enormous fright to your system. And this activates this anxiety bias, or the, as we would say, the fight and flight response. But let me just add in here that it's, you know, that we don't just experience fight and flight, that we actually have three layers of the vagus nerve, and each layer is responsible for helping to protect us. So the first layer of the vagus nerve is the attachment system, so the social engagement system. So when we get something dangerous happens, for example, we reach out for help. So we might reach out for the hand of a loved one. We might pick up the telephone and make a call. We might run towards someone that we know. That's the first thing that we do when we're frightened. The second thing we do is that we mobilize. So fight and flight, that's mobilizing. So you're either going to put your fists up and fight whatever's coming at you, or you're going to flee, you're going to run for the hills. And the third level of the vagus nerve is immobilizing. So this is freeze and collapse. And freeze and collapse are the immobilizing strategies of the brain. So it's a bit like, you know, the cat has a mouse, and the mouse in the mouth of the cat, the mouse feigns death and in the hope that the cat will lose interest in the mouse. And so it's an immobilizing strategy. So what happens is, in any one of those the lower two, the fight, the mobilizing and immobilizing, what happens is that the brain locks into a certain way of responding that cuts out a number of the areas of the brain that we would normally access under normal circumstances. So, for example, your prefrontal cortex, which is your adult intelligent brain, often gets cut off, or the access to it, the connection to it gets severed. And so then we're left only with our limbic responses, which tend to be very young and very frightened and very emotional. And so when if you think about it like the internet, you're losing connection with the internet. You can't do a Google search, you know, so you know that all that information is out there, but you can't access it because you've got no connection to the internet. So it's a little bit like that in the brain. So the prefrontal cortex goes offline, and then you can't access it. So no matter how hard you try, you can't get through because it's no longer online. All you've got left then is, as I said before, are these sort of immature strategies that you then go ahead and do, and then you see yourself doing them, and you go, what the heck, you know, what am I doing this for? I know this doesn't work, but I'm doing it anyway. And then when we catch ourselves behaving like that, then what we tend to do is turn the focus of our attention on ourselves and then blame ourselves and say, oh man, there must be something wrong with me. Why can't I get my act together? And that's the reason why you can't get your act together, is because you can't actually access it. So it is actually a physiological phenomenon. And the other thing that happens is that, you know, in order to be able to regulate ourselves, we need to be able to use both sides of the brain, right brain, left brain. And when we're in a frightened state, we lose the capacity to do that, and we get stuck in one side of the brain. And more importantly, we need to be able to use language as a way of creating a coherent narrative that helps us to understand or make sense of what's happening for us. And when we are in this frightened state, we lose the contact with what's called Broca's area. Broca's area is a certain part of the brain. It was first discovered by Broca. That's why it's called Broca's area. And Broca's area is responsible for language formation. So when we lose connection with Broca's area, we lose the ability to use language. So we lose our ability to talk. And so once we lose our ability to talk, we can't tell a coherent narrative. We can't make sense of what's going on. And so that's also another factor into why you get lost in the fog.
In your experience, like when people come to you, you know, like I did, and go, I can't think straight. I don't know what's happening with me. And people, I'm assuming some of your clients, like myself, would start having like this big rants about, you know, like with a lot of self-criticism and self-judgment. What are some of the insights or some of the guidance that you would give to someone that is experience all those kind of, you know, your brain is going offline, you're in fight or flight or freeze collapse mode, you can't access your prefrontal cortex to be able to reason or to rationalize what your responses are, and you are you can't even get the proper language. You just know something is not right, and then you're blaming yourself. What can be some of the guidance that you would give to someone that is like that, that just suffered a major loss in their lives?
Right. So I can only describe what I do. And that is to, you know, at the very outset, is to try and normalize the situation. And so I like to think of it as, you know, you and your life have just experienced a natural disaster. So it's like a tsunami, it's like a tornado, it's like an earthquake, and your whole world has been shaken. And let's say, if we use the analogy, the earthquake, you know, the whole foundation of your life has been shaken to its core, and there it's happened suddenly, and there, you know, there was no real warning in cases like yours, and everything that you know and everything that you use to orient yourself and to stabilize yourself has just been ripped out from underneath you. And so, you know, I say to people, wow, you know, you've just experienced an earthquake. And, you know, we know that everything is disorienting after an earthquake. Nothing looks the same. You know, there are structures that have been torn down. There are structures that have been cracked terribly. And, you know, if we look at your situation through these kind of eyes, then we can say, of course, you know, you're going to feel like you feel. You're going to be devastated. You're going to be disorientated. You're going to be dysregulated. You're going to be frightened. You're going to be unsure. And these are all the things that people experience when there's a natural disaster like this. And so, you know, presenting from this perspective is like very validating and very normalizing for your response. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with you. It's what's happened to you that is the important thing here. And so if we can move the perspective away from, you know, what's wrong with you or what's happening to you to, you know, what's happening around you, and, you know, this experience that we, you and the people around you have to grapple with, then it becomes less personal and less personalizing. And we're more able to kind of gather together, like, you know, you and I had these conversations about, well, you and me, we have to work our way through this and, you know, gather up the things that are still, you know, that are still usable and, you know, put them back into their right place. And it just takes time to do that. And, but we can do that. And so that's the first thing. And second thing is that we need to be kind to ourselves. And so, you know, if you have children, for example, and they run down the driveway and fall over and scrape their knees and come running and screaming to you, you don't look at them and go, what's wrong with you? Get a hold of yourself. You know, most people, I would say, wouldn't do that. The first thing you would do, you say, oh my, you would look at your child and you say, oh my God, what happened to you? What happened to you? And then you take the time to stop, slow down, pause. You go down to the level of the child size and you wait for them to tell you what just happened to them. And this is like so validating and so orienting towards that something has happened to you. There's nothing wrong with you. And then you go through this process of connecting with your child in the manner that they need connecting with. Oh, wow, that must be so sore. That must be so painful. Oh, my goodness. You know, would you like a hug? And then the first thing you do is you just give them a hug and you rock them and soothe them and go, oh, you know, in such sounds like that, depending on the age of the child. And what you're doing here is you're soothing and comforting the trauma of the first moments of pain. And this is what we need to do with ourselves when we go through a trauma like this. We need to be kind. We need to soothe ourselves. That's the first thing that we need to do. Kindness, loving kindness, pausing, slowing down, paying attention to the pain, soothing it in whatever way that we can, getting people to come alongside us and help us to do that. These are the first steps in dealing with a trauma of this kind.
As you were talking about this analogy of the kid, I'm thinking about my own childhood, which I did not have those responses given to me when I fell down, when I scraped my knee. I remember I fell when I was very little and knocked my tooth out. And so immediately, like, it was that the response I got from the adults around me, which were, they loved me and they were really well-meaning, but it was, they picked me up and go, oh, it's nothing, you know, oh, look at the bird, oh, look at that. And all of a sudden, you are forced to kind of cheer up as a kid. And as you're talking now, and I've had this aha moment during our counseling sessions before, but this came afresh to me again, which is how we actually deal with somebody that's in pain. We try to distract them, and then we never really validate their pain, and they never get the chance to say, this really hurts. Yeah. And so in some ways, I wonder if that distraction or that numbing the pain or distracting away from the pain ends up causing that experience to take root. And it was not something that completed a cycle that you got the chance to talk about it and you got validated and you cried about it and then you shook it off. Yeah. It's in some ways it almost gets imprinted because you never had that cycle of completion of the trauma, even if it's a small trauma. And then they kind of compound. And then all of a sudden you have a major life-altering situation like the death of your husband or the death of a child. And boom, all those other little traumas that have been compounded explode. Am I correct in saying this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. We don't have time to go into it in any great detail, but there's an interesting study on polar bears. And the study shows that when polar bears get injured, they take themselves away and and they try to, the animal equivalent of processing. And one of the particular things that they do is that they actually shake, it's like they're shaking off their pain and their trauma. And this has also been linked to studies in atrocities, like, for example, 9/11, where some people were picked up and put on stretchers, and then they were locked down. They were tied down with straps, obviously to keep them safe. But those people who were tied down on stretchers and then taken to the hospital and not able to process their grief did much more poorly in their recovery than people who were given coffee and donuts in the first instance. And so there's some very interesting research on the treatment of trauma, and it shows definitely that we must allow people to continue their process. So if you're in the middle of an action, you need to complete that action. Mm. If you're in the middle of tears, you need to complete those tears, and so on, just as you described.
And it's interesting because not only, I think a lot of people might relate to what I just shared from my childhood, because I also did that to my kids. And of course, there was to a lesser degree, because I would pick them up and say, what's wrong, and then after a little while, try to distract them into something else, because we don't want the child to hurt and we don't want them to be sad. We want them to be happy. What I found in my experience was that people kind of behaved a little bit like that when they were around me right after Jason died. And so in some ways, there were lots of really well-meaningful, loving friends that wanted to distract me. And when, say, we were in the middle of the distraction, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we went to a movie, maybe we went to have a coffee or a meal together, or even a walk together. And then all of a sudden, I was hit by a new wave of grief. They couldn't just be present with that. They wanted to distract the grief away. And so like, oh, look at that, do you want another coffee? So almost like an adult version of that distracting and not allowing the cycle of the wave of grief to come back. Mm. And I think some people get really scared of triggering a wave of grief in you. Mm. And so they will not even go there, and if you start feeling a little bit tearful, and if you start talking about your loved one, they might really change, literally change the subject. Mm. Or they might not even talk about your loved one when they meet you, as if that person never existed. And in some ways, they are not allowing that space for that little wave of grief to go through, because it washes. I think the waves of grief come and then they subside. They wash through you if you allow them. Otherwise, they just get stored. And then, of course, for me, the widow fog became even stronger. The more I held in and not completed those little cycles of daily grief waves, the less I was able to use my brain in a functional way. Mm. Would you agree with that? Is that...
Yes, absolutely. I think that says it very well. As we've said before, the neurological reasons for that are because you're inhibiting the processing, and your brain registers that as dangerous, and so therefore you enter into fight and flight response again, and you lose contact with your prefrontal cortex and your ability to, as I said before, to create a narrative that makes sense of your situation, and therefore you get locked up in the incoherent narrative of the trauma, and that is actually quite dangerous, because it can lead to what we call complicated grief. Mm. So it's unprocessed grief will lead to complicated grief, and complicated grief can lead in time to complex PTSD, which will then lead you to potentially a major depressive episode. So it's very important to be able to dive deeply into the grief. And there is, you know, there's lots of information in grief theory about diving deep. So the people who dive deep into their grief and allow themselves to experience it, as you say, the depths of the grief can come up and out into the open air more quickly than those who try to dive shallow and don't allow themselves to process.
I think that this was very true for me, and it was one of those things that when I say that the therapy sessions that we had, and you being in my life, and I also had other important practitioners in my life, such as my my doctor, my family doctor. I also had a chiropractor that guided me through helping me process the grief that was happening through my body. I think that diving deeply with the right help, it's really important because in my experience was really scary to do it by myself because I felt like that if I did go there, I would never come up for air again. And having guidance was really important. One of the things that was really also quite crucial for me that happened through Insight Therapy with you was giving myself permission to grieve. But not only that, but giving myself permission to grieve my way. I did not know how to grieve because I never lost a husband before. I had other griefs in my life, but this really was the most painful experience of my life. And so when I was doing therapy with you, it was like every time I would come there and having a safe space where I could just say it all. I didn't have to measure my words. I didn't have to be worried if you would cut me off your life, you know, as we would with friends. Sometimes we try to measure our words because we don't want people to abandon us in our time of need. But with you was really different because I could come there and be my completely authentic, raw self and say everything that was in my mind. And after that hour, it was almost like I was raged out. All the rage was there. All the fear was laid there and in that room. And I was able to take another breath because I had that moment to go deep into all the really scary feelings, all the really scary just trauma that I was facing, and then come up for air once again. But yeah, finding that permission to grieve in a safe way, but also permission to grieve in my particular way, because I think a lot of people have their own perspective on what acceptable ways of grieving is, and they want to impose that on the person that's grieving, and that just traumatizes them even more. It's kind of like, oh, look at the cat over there, you know, don't grieve the way that you're grieving, grieve the way I think it's proper. And that's really unhelpful, if not toxic.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. And that's one of the things that we can do and give to people who are grieving, most importantly, is to is the space for that grieving person to grieve in the way that they want to grieve and need to grieve. And even if we don't say anything much, if we just provide that safe space, then that is a therapeutic moment. There's Elizabeth Gilbert says how to move through grief as grief moves through you. I quite like that. She says, grief is a force of energy that cannot be controlled or predicted. Grief does not obey your plans or your wishes. Grief will do whatever it wants to you whenever it wants to. And in that regard, grief has a lot in common with love. And I quite like the way she says that. It's sort of like, you know, you know, grief is a thing that you can't control. All you can do is manage it and go with it, like the lapping waves of grief as they lap all over you.
Yeah, I like that too. Because I think sometimes grief can feel like a really big, scary monster that you want to lock away in a basement. But I guess if I had a basement with a dragon in my basement, that dragon wouldn't be just quietly sitting there, right? It would be making some noise, scaring me regardless. So yeah, I think that I have definitely learned through a lot of different sessions that I had with you and other people in my life to really allow myself to face my grief, in some ways actually to embrace my grief and to be protective of it, because my grief was something that still is. I mean, I'm doing a podcast on it, you know, for God's sake, you know, it's like, it's a very precious part of my relationship with Jason and my relationship with my grandmother that passed away, with the baby that we lost, that I never really fully processed those griefs before. And now they all came in to join the grief party, you know, and I have some miserable days, but then I have some days where my grief is actually a gift to me that, that reminds me to slow down. It reminds me of what is really important in this moment, that grounds me into not catastrophizing again, because, you know, I have the tendency to do that, especially when I'm not feeling that great. And talking about this, one of the things that you mentioned, because I sent you a few questions, you talked about two things that I just want to explore. One was about holding on to your life raft when you, especially in early stages of grief. And I'm assuming that by life raft, you mean like some well-being practices. And I know that for you, one of your well-being practices is love and kindness meditation. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like, how can people create or discover what can be part of their life raft, as in, you know, their wellness practices that they can do every single day?
Yes. So love and kindness, and, you know, so there is a whole body of research out there, and it positivity studies, love and kindness studies, self-compassion, love, happiness, micro moments of love. These are all different studies that focus in on these types of emotions. And what we do know now, and in particular in the last 5 years from the studies, is that loving kindness, let's just use one term for the sake of brevity, loving kindness as an emotion, when it's experienced, has an impact on you at a chemical level. So loving kindness is an emotion. Focusing on loving kindness, promoting loving kindness, experiencing physiologically loving kindness actually changes the chemical makeup in your body. And the chemicals, the neurochemicals that are produced are serotonin, endorphins, oxytocin, and we get 2 times the DHEA chemical, which is responsible for allowing stem cells to create new tissue in the body, whichever tissue is needed. And we get 23% less cortisol, and we also get more dopamine. So these neurochemicals are, when they're released in our bodies, they actually create a healing environment, not only psychologically and emotionally, but also physiologically. So your brain's going to function more effectively, your body's going to function more effectively, your veins are going to dilate so that you get more oxygen to your brain, your heart's going to beat more effectively, your vagal tone is going to be improving, which actually affects the impact, the health of your heart. It allows the sugars in your body to be absorbed more effectively. So you're creating this environment, if you like, of natural healing. So love and kindness, I like to say that love and kindness is the healing feeling. It is a feeling, but it's a healing feeling for all these reasons that I've just said.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And also love and kindness helps you to open up. And the what needs to happen in our brain is of course to come out of that locked down position and to open up. And if you imagine a sea anemone underneath the water, is a perfect example of that. You know, when it's frightened, it closes up like this, and when it's closed, it can't take in any new nutrients.
Mm.
So it can't stay in a state like that. It has to open up again. And it, once it opens up, and it, when it's in a safe position and opens up, then it starts taking in all the nutrients. Well, the human brain is exactly the same as that. So in a lockdown position, we can't take in new data. And if we can't have new awarenesses, we can't learn anything new, then we can't move on. And so loving kindness helps to create this loving and kind, safe environment where we can be a sea anemone that opens up. And then we can begin to see things that we wouldn't otherwise see. And if you imagine, you know, you go from tunnel vision to a V-shaped vision, then anything on the periphery of that tunnel that wouldn't have otherwise seen, these are the moments of aha. They're the insights that we get, the revelations that we get that are life-changing. And from a psychological perspective, but also from a neurological perspective, you know, our neurons are able to reconfigure them, their constructs. And so that's life-changing.
That's awesome. And then, of course, the widow's fog and the widow's brain kind of opens up as well. The fog lifts, even if it's briefly, you know, and then the more you do that, then the more respite you have. Yeah. And then, of course, the fog comes and it dissipates more easily the more you practice that. Yeah.
Yeah. And another thing that I'd like to say about that is that in loving kindness creates this state of mind. And then it expands your perspective so you can see a bigger picture, as I said. But it also helps you to be more flexible and attuned. And it also helps you to connect with your creativity and your inner wisdom. And therefore, it helps you to be more resourceful and knowledgeable and therefore more resilient. And resilience is the thing that you need to have a sense of or a sniff of that leads you to the hope for going forward.
It's interesting that you're saying that, because I think that initially I was thinking I need to become resilient. I need to become resilient. And I was forcing myself to become resilient and then judging myself, which was the opposite of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Because I really needed to stop and give myself that, my inner child that was really traumatized, you know, and give myself that love, that kindness. And then the consequence of that would be to become more resilient.
Yes.
And I think we try to do the other way around and it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, Pauline.
Really good point.
I just love talking to you. I think that you are amazing in so many ways. So we're about to close. But before we do that, I just have a couple of questions for you. Mm-hmm. So say that for today, you got only today to live. This would be your very last day on this earth. Mm. How would you choose to spend this day? What would you do? Who would you talk to? What would you say to them?
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. And if you'd asked me that years ago, it probably would have been a different answer to what I would say today. And because of my recent studies into loving kindness and another study called Micro Moments of Love by Barbara Fredrickson, I can see that from a neurological perspective, that love is the super emotion, and that we can create micro moments of love in a micro moment. That's what it's all about. And we can actually make that happen with anybody that we're with, if we participate in the way that I have suggested through this podcast, that we can, you know, I know this needs to be a short story, but but if we follow the neuroscience of creating micro moments of love, then we can create this meaningful moment of connection with anyone we make contact with. And so, what would I do? I would go to each of the members of my family and I would endeavor to create those micro moments of love. I would want them to look into my eyes and to experience my love that is freely delivered and freely given in that moment, so they would know at a very deep level that they were connected to me, irrespective of, you know, any kind of, you know, complicated life situations, that they would just have that raw experience of love. Because I think that the human being responds most profoundly to this super emotion, love. And that is what I would want to leave people with.
I really love that because I think I am very quick to use words. I love words and I love to express myself through my words. And I often thought about this question as I ask people, and it's so interesting to hear all the different, well, not so different. It has a pattern, like everybody would say, I would spend time with my family and the people I love most. But what I love about your answer was looking into their eyes, because often we try to express our love for people just through saying things in the last moment. Say, I have a last hour with you. I'm going to tell you how much I love you. But that being present just and looking into somebody's eyes, which is the windows of their soul and the two souls connecting, I think that that's really, really powerful. And there is this language of love that supersedes any words that we can tell people.
You know, another amazing phenomenon when looking into people's eyes, holding the gaze, there are a number of things that need to be present. So that there needs to be goodwill. There needs to be the intention of connection and kindness. There needs to be the gazing into each other's eyes. There needs to be the pause and taking that time. And there needs to be the crinkling of the eyes, because that activates the vagus nerve, which activates the attachment system. And there needs to be the holding of the gaze, you know, for as long as you can and as long as it feels comfortable. But what also happens in this case is that you get what's called brain coupling. Brain coupling is a phenomena where your brain and my brain start firing up in exactly the same way.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it's amazing. So it's like we have this brain coupling synchronicity where it's like almost like we have a sort of a joint brain. So there's three brains in the room at the time. And so this is how we experience one another quite profoundly, because our brains are tuning in.
And I think that this reminds me so much of when my kids were babies and they were, you know, babies just gazing to your eyes, like they're piercing your soul. And that is just so incredibly satisfying and fulfilling. And experiences full of love, just holding my babies and looking into their eyes.
Yeah,
that's awesome. All right. So last question.
Yep.
Say now that you had a whole year. 1 year, and that's it. And at the end of this year, you would be, you know, having your journey elsewhere. You would live this life. And what is the kind of legacy that you would want to leave behind if you only have 1 year to live?
Such an interesting question, isn't it? It's like so challenging how to distill it down to one important thing. And there are, you know, of course, to live, to love, and to leave a legacy is something that's always been profoundly with me all through my years. But the thing that I would like to leave most is this understanding that I have acquired over these numerous years of the importance of love and kindness and micro moments of love. I would like to share that with everybody that I love, and to you know, in a very sort of generous and loving and non-commanding kind of way, obviously. You know, it would be an invitation to listen. But yeah, it just feels so important to me that that I would want to share it, and this would be the legacy of my journey, my psychological learning journey, that I could impart that. The things, you know, some of the things that I've given to you, that I could give that to my family,
yeah,
and the people that I love. This would be really critically important, and of course, words of love and words of encouragement.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I can tell you for sure that one of the legacies that you would leave behind in my life, that I'm passing down to my children's life, is everything that I have learned through your guidance with insight focus neurotherapy. I think it's an amazing modality, and I would highly recommend to anyone, not only for people that are struggling with grief, but any kind of trauma, or even when people are really just struggling with going, I don't have any major traumas in my life, but why can't I get my life together? Why can't I do the things that I want to do in this world? I think that people can highly benefit from the modality that you created. I think you're nothing short of amazing, Pauline.
Oh, thank you, Kelly.
And I mean... And well, we have come to the end of our conversation, but I do want to acknowledge you. Thank you so much for being willing to have this conversation with me and sharing a little drop in the bucket of all the amazing things that you know. I hope we get to do this again. Thank you so much for your vulnerability as well, for your courage in sharing, because I also know that you have experienced grief by losing loved ones as well. So everything that you are sharing right now, it's all the things that you live. And that's really amazing about you. So now, I just think that I should also acknowledge your parents that have passed away, because I know that grieving them have also give you the perspectives that you have now. And you know, thank God for them, for raising you. You're a gift to the world. I also want to acknowledge my husband, Jason, because without his life and his death, I wouldn't be here having this conversation. It would have been a different conversation. But
that's right. And I wouldn't have met you.
That's right. And you know, I remember you saying something to me that at that time I actually resented it, because you said Jason's death will be the making of you. And at that time I was just like, oh, how dare she? but now you know, it's been only 3 years and 3 months since Jason's death. But I can see that you're right, that having you and other people in my life to go deep into the grief has really shaped me. And I'm becoming a person that I really love to be with. And, you know, wherever I am, there I am. So it's kind of it's kind of nice to like me, like my But it would not have happened if Jason's death had not been that earthquake that really shook me, and I would have to rebuild who I am. And it is becoming the making of me, of the new me. And thank you for that. It was hard to hear, but really important. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you having this conversation with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. And now, my darling, who have been listening to this conversation, thank you for your time and your attention. Chances are you found Crazy Grief because you are grieving the death of your person, or you want to support someone who is grieving. I am truly sorry that our paths have crossed in this way, but I am glad that we found each other. My email is on the show notes. Please reach out. I would love to hear from you. I will also put Pauline's email and how you can contact her on the show notes. I just want to make a mention that she offers mindfulness in practice courses that several times a year. There is one coming up soon. Please check out her website. Again, the link is on the show notes. Have a look at it. And I have done them. They are incredible. You can put into practice a lot of the themes that we talked about today. And again, not only for people who are grieving, but for anyone, this is really beneficial. It has been beneficial for me to apply some of those principles with my kids as well. Pauline also have a couple of books. I will put the details of that on the show notes. Please do check it out, okay? And do subscribe to this podcast and leave us a 5-star rating so we can continue to produce more meaningful conversations about grief. And remember, you are not going crazy. You are just grieving. Take a moment to breathe. Take a moment to refocus, you know, and reach out to someone you trust. And do be kind and loving to yourself. Light and peace.